Hi, biohackers, and welcome back to the Biohacker Podcast. I'm your host, David James Clark IV, here with the esteemed, never imitated, always original, your friend and mine, Dr. Alex Filtus. How you doing today, Alex?
Hey David.
that was quite an opening. Speaking of opening, cue the opening music. All right. I never get tired of that. Okay. So today we're meeting with Mark Birtwistle, who's a really interesting guy, dynamic cellular models. And as I was doing a little bit of research before this episode, I was struck by this concept of wet lab versus dry lab. And you have this cool term that I've heard you say a few times, in silico. Which basically means doing science in silicon, for all you Latin fans out there, which implies computational biology. But Mark's a really interesting Renaissance man in that he does wet and dry. Yep. So why don't you talk for a second about the difference, between wet science and dry science and what in silico means?
Yeah. So not too long ago, let's call it a couple of decades since the human genome came online. There really weren't a lot of a lot of data generating measurement techniques, right? Like you take a picture of the cells in a microscope and, that kind of stuff. And it was really low throughput measurements. What's happened is these high throughput measurements where you can measure millions of DNA molecules at the same time and all that. And that's led to being able to forcing you to be able to do your analysis, not by hand on a piece of paper or in Excel, but using, high performance computing and cloud computing to do a lot of your analytics. And so the biology lab is still doing the same stuff, but a higher resolution that requires this computation. So what's happened now is there's labs that sort of specialize in dry lab in silico science, where they're maybe doing proper experimentation or developing software, on the computer, but they're actually using measurements that came from the wet lab, right? So none of the work that I do generated from nothing. It came from actual experiments at the wet lab, at traditional experiments. I was actually trained in the wet lab, and so I understand the nuances and just the troubles of doing wet lab science, and I understand the troubles of doing dry lab science, which is computational biology, what I do right now. Mark is one of these scientists who bridges both worlds, and I think that's going to be more and more common as we move forward. But he also has a third world that is something that I would, I'm jealous of, wish I could do more, is he actually develops mathematical models of how genes are changing over time, and does from a cancer perspective, right? And so he's not only doing wet bench and in silico work, but he's also modeling what's happening. And so the model is always think back to weather. I remember my uncle, who's probably, 80 now or something like that, who lived in South Alabama, talking about the birds flying by in a weird way. And so there's a hurricane coming. And I was like, oh, they didn't have Doppler radar. It's like, I've just created for granted my whole life. Yeah, yeah. And so the same thing's happening now, right? Where it's you have the ability to predict the weather of the cell. We have Doppler radar, which is DNA sequencing technology and in silico biology, coming together to try to understand this. And so I think what's going to happen, I bet you I'm going to be dust by this time, but when the century rolls around again, people will be using models and saying, hey, look, plug in this person's DNA and let's see what happens if we give them this drug. And it will be, probably really dark, 1800s biology, now then, if it doesn't happen even sooner, because people won't even understand a lot of what we're doing right now, because it's so primitive, even though right now it is science fiction realized right now. So anyway, I think Mark is the kind of a blueprint of a person, a normal scientist, 50 to 100 years from now. And I bet you Mark will agree that his models are very primitive and we have a long way to go, but they're still very powerful.
The thing that's so cool about math is obviously it can be used to represent and model anything. And we've talked in previous podcasts about linear and nonlinear, you know, equations and the way that you can approach. I know Reed talked about, you know, joining a biotech company, and he had his kind of traditional microbiologists who were, you know, kind of in wet bench and doing the gels, and he came in with his computational models, and it seems like voodoo to them. So, you know, it is interesting to see this crossover a little bit, you know, where someone's both wet and dry, and it sounds like mathematical at the same time. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how he's trying to reconcile all those things in his brain. Quick story I'll tell you about my time as a geneticist when I was doing cancer research way back when, you know, in the wet lab. You know, there is a an inherent risk. I was doing some, you know, radioactive gels and dropped some on my Air Jordans. And these were like, you know, generation one Air Jordans. They were
Probably worth like $1 million now if they're in mint condition.
Priceless. Priceless. Yeah. And I had that whole Silkwood incident, you know, where they just they hosed me down and threw away my Air Jordans. And so so great, you know, great lesson for all you biohackers out there. You know, 21st century, you don't have to worry about that. You can wear your Air Jordans in peace and crank out your in silico experiments. All right. Well, hey, that's a great segue into our guest, Mark, and let's bring him onto the show.
Looking forward to it.
Hey, again, welcome back. We've got our guest, Mark Birtwistle, here with us today. How you doing today, Mark?
Hey, I'm great.
All right. All right. Rumor has it you've got a great story to tell us about your career and how you got into science. I know your biohackers are going to love to hear that story. But first, Alex, why don't you tell us a little bit about our guest and how you and Mark got connected?
Yeah, this is cool because this is the end point, right? And we'll see what happened up until when I met you. But I met Mark, but we're working at the same institution at Clemson University. I guess we've known each other for quite a few years now, right?
Probably almost 5 years?
5 years, something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Mark came into the university. He was doing you know, modeling and bioinformatics. I heard about this guy and went and met him. And he's a rare person that blends together, or he really is like a mathematical modeling of and predictions of what's going to happen in a cellular system, which is something that's really cool to me and very useful. But also, I was super intrigued, Mark, when I learned that you were doing the wet bench work and doing things which you could talk about, I guess, for your company, like being able to do high throughput, you know, wet bench, you know, validations, and you know, modifying your models to not just be like really cool models that, you know, kind of describe something, but actually real practical models and understanding systems. And so I met him as a, you know, a wet bench scientist in a chemical engineering, I'm sorry, what is the actual name of your department? I always forget.
Our department's name is Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering. I also have a joint appointment in bioengineering.
And so he's on the engineering side of things, and I'm much more of a basic scientist kind of thing. And so anyway, it was just like, Mark is a great example of like an interdisciplinary person that I need to work with, and I certainly enjoy working with too, to be able to like fill in so many gaps and things that I do. And so that's who I see him as. And I can't wait to hear how you got there, because I don't think I know the story.
Yes. And so, Mark, please do tell us how one becomes a Marie Curie chair of biomedical engineering.
Oh, okay. So I never set out to be a professor, and I'll qualify that just based on there's so many undergraduates that come into my office that are interested in doing research, and a large percentage of them are just so dead set on like, I want to go to med school, and these are all the things that I want to do and I need to do, and like they have their next 15 or 20 years mapped out. And I get the pressure that the system puts on them, especially with how competitive med school has become to get into it, or even just good PhD programs. And maybe that's more of a systemic issue of systemic brokenness, maybe, but they feel that pressure. And so I like to share my experience of like, hey, like, you don't really know what's going to happen, and you don't have to have it all figured out, really. Like, and you might change your mind, and that's okay. And really all you have to do is do your best and see what life is going to throw at you this day. Cause like, okay, when I started, I knew I liked engineering. My dad was an engineer. Like, okay, I'll apply to a few engineering schools when I was in high school. Like, I had good grades and everything. It's like, okay, I applied to two places. Like, how many places do kids apply to nowadays? I don't know. 20, 30, 50?
Yeah.
I don't know. I applied to two places. High school in Georgia. So I applied to Georgia Tech. And at that time, it could be free because they had the lottery scholarships. Like, I should apply there because that would be great. And it's a good school. And then I applied to MIT. I got rejected from MIT. I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to Georgia Tech. Luckily, they accepted me. So I went there. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was like, oh, biochemistry is really cool. I like that idea. Let me. And back then, like, it wasn't really digital, like, which is weird. It's like you wrote down your major on a piece of paper and handed it in to somebody.
Yeah.
So I wrote down biochemistry, handed this piece of paper in. And they come back to me like, we don't have that major. I'm like, what? Okay. I guess I should have checked the major list before I wrote down a major. Right. So so, okay, we're going to stick you in chemistry. I'm like, okay. So I get over to chemistry, start looking at it, taking some of the class, like, oh, okay. I don't really like this so much. I guess I'll just switch to chemical engineering. Mm. So I switched to chemical engineering, did well in that curriculum. And then I was just going along and I got a co-op job position at a newsprint company. And so what do they make? They make newspaper. That was a dying industry 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what it's like now if I'd stayed in there. But I learned a lot about how do you make newsprint. And I was doing an event for the newsprint company I was working at. And somebody from Georgia Tech came across one of the stations I was manning talking about how we're saving water. So it was about combined economic and environmental objectives we were changing the plant to do better on. And she's like, oh, you go to Georgia Tech? I could really use somebody that's an undergraduate researcher that knows about this process and is a student there. Like, okay, will you pay me? She said, yeah. I was like, okay,
you're on.
So I started getting into research that way. And I started researching and I got her name was Carol Carmichael. And then she's like, OK, you need an advisor in your major. So she paired me up with a guy named Matthew Ralph. He was a chemical engineering faculty member and started getting into that research. And my advisor from the chemi side, he's like, you know, I guess he started looking at my grades. I had really good grades. Like, you know, you have really good grades and you seem to be really good at this research thing. You should consider going to graduate school. Like, oh, okay. I never really considered that before, but fine. And so at the time it was like end of 2002, 2003, when I was graduating with my undergraduate degree, bachelor's. And the economy wasn't the best. And I was like, okay, well, I might not get a really good job, so I might as well go to grad school. And so I applied to, I think, two or three places. I got into Carnegie Mellon at the University of Delaware, decided to go to University of Delaware because they had more kind of projects available because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I said, okay, I'm going to Delaware. So I ended up there. And then, pick an advisor, pick a project. Fine. And so one of the projects I saw was getting into cancer research and like, oh, how can we use chemical engineering to try to do a better job of understanding cancer? It's like, oh, like that seems really cool. Like I always loved biochemistry. And like I at that time, I hadn't seen biology since high school at this point. And I'm like, you know, that's for me. I could do something like that. Or I kind of view the alternative as like, okay, I can work on some catalyst for some reaction that might save some big chemical company a couple cents per whatever unit and like make them a bunch of money. And fine, that science is good, but it didn't really appeal to me as much as something like that.
Yeah.
Like, okay. And so I started working with Tunde Oganaki was my advisor in chemical engineering, who unfortunately just passed away not too long ago. Great man. And I was co-advised by a guy named Boris Kolodenko, who was at Jefferson Medical School in Philadelphia.
Mm.
So I split my time between those two places and I started just diving into understanding and learning biochemistry again, because that was always one of my passions. Like I loved the stuff and I just got involved with that and learning the medical school kind of research side of things, but also infusing that with engineering. Got up to speed with all of that stuff. And that's kind of like what started to define me as a researcher and my research career and trajectory, and like combining engineering approaches with understanding how cancer cells work. Mm. I realized I like teaching. Like, okay, maybe I should try to stay as an academic. Like, I should try to get a postdoc job. And like, it's like the same old rinse and repeat story for me. Yeah. Like, I don't know where I'm going tomorrow. Okay. So like, I realized that, I should probably do a postdoc. And so a collaborator of Boris Kolodenko, my co-advisor, was like, I would love to have a postdoc like you that knows modeling, but wants to learn more wet lab research. Cause I decided like, yeah, I know a lot of modeling, but I need to become like a card carrying cell and molecular biologist to really do this right. Mm-hmm. So I got a postdoc job with him. He was the only place I really applied to. Went over to Scotland and Ireland for a little while. Mm. That's where I got the Marie Curie Fellowship, because I applied for that and got it. So that was paying me. Yeah, thanks. That was paying me a decent salary. I didn't realize that it was paying me much more than a normal postdoc. Mm. And that, I guess that's like something I touched on a little bit, but like I didn't always have a lot of money going through school. Yeah. I wasn't ready. So that was always kind of like a big concern, and that is important for some students and not for others.
Yeah.
And so like that is something that shaped my trajectory quite a bit, because when I eventually came off that Marie Curie Fellowship, and then they told me what postdocs really make, I'm like, I'm going to have to go into debt living here.
I got lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I had gotten married in graduate school and I had two kids.
Wow.
And so, money was tight.
Yep.
And so I'm like, I guess I'm going to start looking for faculty jobs. And, I had plans to move back to the States and try to figure that out. But right before I moved back to the States, the department chair at Mount Sinai School of Medicine and Pharmacology came over there as one of the reviewers of the lab that I was in, the institute that I was in. He saw my poster. He was asking about me. He's like, "Hey, are you looking for jobs?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You should apply to our department." His name was Ravi Iyengar.
Ooh.
And so I applied for a faculty job in his department. And basically on the plane trip back home that I had already planned, I landed in New York City and I just went to interview with him in his department. And I got an offer for a faculty spot in pharmacology at Mount Sinai. I was like, that's a good offer. I guess I don't really need to do much more. And that's how I started my lab at the medical school.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, what did he see in you?
Right? Like how did,
But what was it about the poster that intrigued him? Was it like the interdisciplinary aspect or just,
I don't know for sure, but I think I think he knew of my work because we work in kind of related fields, like building mechanistic models of how cells work in terms of their biochemistry. But also he saw me combining that modeling with experimental techniques, and he knew that was like a really powerful thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a fantastic story. And so, I mean, that you wouldn't have gotten there without, I mean, if you, it's funny that you love biochemistry, but they didn't have the major. You went to the wrong school that gets you on the right path. You know what I mean? You went to fantastic, Georgia Tech is such a fantastic school. But like, so how do you see yourself as like a, I mean, you're doing really cool work. You're doing very contemporary work. Do you think that you're this blend of, you know, you're a nexus of many different disciplines in your lab, including engineering, right? Which is really rare, mm-hmm. right? When you're doing this kind of stuff. Like, are you the lab of the future? I mean, I don't want you to toot your own horn, but like, you know what I mean? Like, do you think that everything will evolve this way? And is it possible that you can have a person like you wear so many hats?
Certain people can be ambidextrous like that.
Yeah.
Some people can and some people can't. And that doesn't mean that the people that can't don't have a future in any of these fields. Facts. I think there's still room for all of these types. And even people in my lab, like I mean, there's certain projects and directions where I want to go, but if it doesn't fit the person, then it doesn't matter because I need the people to do the work. And so some people might come in and they're like, just butterfingers in the wet. Like they can't, yeah. they can't hold a pipette, you know, they're just accident prone or something. Like, okay, you're going to stay with coding.
Right? Yeah.
And then there's some people that just make things work in the lab. They're just really good, but ask them to write a simple piece of code and they're like, you know, they just can't. And that's fine. So, I think there's room for people like that in my labs, and there's room for people like that. And then, they can just collaborate when they need the different expertise. I do think the fields in general, in a very broad sense, it's going, modern biology, it's very hard to get by doing state of the art research without integrating computation, big data sets, and like just fundamental good experimental biology.
Yeah, definitely.
You got to do it. You got to have all of that to really do cutting edge science in the field nowadays. And whether you combine that in one roof or whether you have really good collaborators you work well with and trust, I don't think that matters as much how you get there.
Yeah. Do you think that so one of the constraints I see in higher ed for interdisciplinary work is just the structure of departments and colleges and things like that. Like you and I are in different colleges, right? So it's actually a bureaucratic problem sometimes to share students and resources. Like it's, you know, usually there's some way around it, but it's difficult. Go outside of your university and it's, you know, even more difficult. But do you think that like universities can be structured to facilitate like the kind of work that you do? Or is it basically like, you know, is it impossible to do it that way? To make it, you know, of course everybody can still do it, but it's just so much harder. The, you know, the activation energy is so high to be able to make it work. And I find this meandering paths and luck sometimes that give you the right skills to make it happen.
There's a lot to be said for that. And just, but I think the incentive structures are really where it lies. And like some, if they set up the right incentive structures or alternatively take down the wrong disincentive structures.
There you go. Yeah. Yep.
Then those things would flow more naturally. And one of the units, like how do you do a research, like a biomedical or biotechnology research project nowadays? Well, really like you need some student to work on that, which is normally a PhD student.
Yeah.
So if there's mechanisms that allow easy sharing and recruitment of PhD students, like for instance, at Clemson, we have the BDSI program.
Right.
And that is a really, I think one of the really good mechanism by which it'll really facilitate interdisciplinary work. That is like, we're just asking good scientific questions that are applicable to a lot of quote departments or silos, but we can recruit a student into this BDSI program. That's biomedical data science and
informatics. Yeah.
So for all you listening, that's a great program. You should think about applying if you want to go to a PhD program. But it's like discipline agnostic, right? You come into this program and you just have, okay, you can choose me as your mentor. You can choose Alex as your mentor. You can choose both of us as co-mentors or any of the affiliated faculty from all across the departments at Clemson to be your research mentor.
And the medical school in USC too. There's actually two institutions involved, which is a bureaucracy miracle.
Right. I don't know how Brian Dean pulled that off, but I'm really grateful that he did. I programs like that, I think are the foundation for getting that kind of work done, because it provides the students who are going to do the work and the ability for us to communicate and collaborate in a way where now we're just guiding that student science.
Yes.
And then it can happen.
Interesting.
So interdisciplinary Renaissance man, Mark Birtwistle, that was a great story. And I love the whole, you know, kind of meandering element of it. And the key thing is, you know, we had a whole podcast earlier about chaos theory. It sounds a little bit like, you know, your path, you know, was opportunistic and,
interesting.
You know, but the beautiful part about the story is that, you know, you dove into opportunities, kept your mind open. You tried chemistry, you tried chemical engineering. And when you needed to learn, you know, biology, when you needed to apply biology to your research, you went and learned biochemistry, you know, you dove into it. So that kind of willingness to learn and be open, that's something, you know, Praxis is trying to do with the biohackathons and the biohacker community, that, you know, the cross-functional interdisciplinary nature of that. So let's talk a little bit about your science, because it sounds like, you know, we've got the wet lab, the dry lab, and the mathematical models. Earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that once a cell goes static, it's dead, and that all things are dynamic. And so the idea of a dynamic cellular model and what role that plays in not only your research, but also, you know, the larger body of work around cancer discovery, biology, et cetera.
Yeah, so that's, I forgot that I said that, but I think it's also scientifically quite established that if a cell is at thermodynamic equilibrium, it's dead. Like a cell lives by driving things away from a thermodynamic equilibrium, mm-hmm. like in a static state. Like it's constantly adapting and constantly a flux of all sorts of things, of energy, of molecules are going through in and out of that cell. So the very concept of a static cell is not like you can't understand cell biology by thinking about it as a snapshot. It's just always moving and living. And so I think when I think about understanding a cell, I guess because I'm an engineer and kind of like gravitate towards a real understanding comes from a theory. And in a theory, like how do we represent theories? Usually in terms of math. And so unless we can start doing that to understand how a cell works, then how much do we really understand about that cell? And so if dynamics and temporal aspects of cellular behavior are really important for cellular function, then that needs to be a core part of whatever model language we use to try to ask ourselves, do we really understand a cell or not?
Mm.
And so that's, I guess, like it's really philosophical and like high level, but that's why I like why I'm so rooted in mathematical modeling approaches to understanding how cells work and why I think those model, like any model that doesn't have time as a part of it is just incomplete.
Mm.
Oh man, let's that go down this
path. Not useful, but like
here we go.
But this is is this an engineering perspective or is this a Burt Whistle perspective or a little bit of both? Like, where does this come from?
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, it's definitely my perspective, but it's really influenced by the engineering upbringing, I guess, that I had.
Yeah. And that's an engineering that I love. I always think that somebody coined the term genetic engineering. I don't know who did it way too early. Cause I mean, that's basically like just hammering a system where you overexpress a gene or, you know, got the technology to kill genes and stuff like that. And it's not engineering. It's like, you know, shooting at a, you know, something and see if it blows up. Right. kind of thing. But so this is one of the hardest things, and it's so obvious, but it's so, I think, not really thought about enough, like from a, like I'm trained as a biochemist to cell, but it was a cell biology, it was my PhD, the department I was in and things like that. It was actually in a developmental biology curriculum or department I was in it where I got my PhD. So they were looking at dynamic processes, but the problem is destructive sampling, right? When you go and you take you put a frog on the blender and you see what's happening inside the frog, you get a snapshot and then you're like, okay, well, I'm going to go do it again. You're like, oh, well, I blended up the frog, so I can't, right? So like so many things we do are we're measuring these dynamic things, like you treat something with a drug and see what happens, but then you get maybe a snapshot of something before and after, but you get like two photographs. And I always think about it like a Polaroid snapshot. If I gave you two pictures of my life, one when I was, you know, 8 and then, you know, 3 years ago, and then told you to explain my life, like you couldn't do it, right? But if I give you a whole bunch of snapshots, maybe you could start to reconstruct something.
Right.
So like, and that's to me, that's what the model is. Like if we get good enough in understanding the principles of how things work, then, you know, they're sort of realistic, if not very realistic, then it's a much better way than actually doing an actual measurement. But you can't do those. You can't build those models without the measurements. Right. So,
right. You need to have confidence in that model first. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can do that. I mean, could you talk about how you, with your what your model is and how you have confidence that it's not, you know, garbage in, garbage out? Why do you think your model works? Like the evidence, not so much like, you know, peer review level explanation, but like, you know, like qualitatively, how do you know your model? What is it doing?
So first I should qualify a little bit, like, cause there's lots of different mathematical formalisms by which one can model biological data. And, the formalisms that we tend to use are, we call them mechanistic models. And that's a lot what we learn in chemical engineering. And we call them first principles, where to contrast it from a so-called like a statistical model, or as is practiced a lot nowadays, is like machine learning or like big data, right? Statistical models that just relate two data sets together so that if you're given one, you can predict the other. The guts of that model don't necessarily reflect any particular mechanisms or anything causal between what you're seeing as the input versus the output. The types of models that we build are formed on some sort of causal assumptions of A does B does C, and then C comes back and does something to A, and then C, and like whatever is going on in the cell. Yeah. So inherently, we formulate models on that level. Okay, so that's I guess point one, and so because we're doing it that way, we have an ability to really stand. I'm going to use cliche, stand on the shoulders of giants, because there's been so much work done to understand causality, like one gene at a time, since whatever, the 1960s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
Cell and molecular biologists have been studying, okay, like I know that this gene and this gene product interacts with this and interacts with that. And this is an enzyme for this, and it changes whatever. So a lot of that knowledge is there, but it's just not put together, because can you really understand how a cell works by understanding one gene? Like, no, you have to understand how they all work together in a system. And so the way that we, what really gives me at least some confidence in the types of models that we build is that we're taking that, what we call prior knowledge, and we have that basis of causality that is kind of well understood to be a ground truth.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that, I mean, there's a lot in there that we don't know. And there's probably a lot in there that's not right for some reason, but at least we're starting from that basis, which gives us some confidence that at least the structure of what we're dealing with is grounded in truth.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. And it's really cool. And it makes sense, but also like, there's just so much to it, right? It's like a lifelong kind of question. But like, so your model, so correct me if I'm wrong about this, but if I'm oversimplifying it, but like one of the models that I've used and worked with you on is where you have a cell, and that cell could be, assumed to be a tumor cell, or, it has like some tissue aspects to it. Right. And then you go through your model and you propagate through your model over time, right? And time is not real time, right? It's simulated time. And what happens? And then the output is, does a cell divide, or does it commit suicide and commit apoptosis, and which is something that happens normally. Mm-hmm. And so like that model it's so cool to do that, but I'm trying to think where my question is. I can't keep thinking about a question, but there was one thing that really blew me away is one of my students was using your model. She was working on it and she was trying to use it for some experiments we were trying to do. We're actually trying to use some of our experiments, by using it. And she didn't really understand cell biology. She was very, very young. And she kind of like through conversations admitted that she didn't really understand this whole, the process. Right. And she started learning cell biology from your model. And so she had to go back in the cell biology book and see what this gene did and that gene and everything. And it's almost like, sometimes you see students' eyes light up when they figure something out. Well, she did that like times 100, right? So she not only started to understand what was happening because of your model, but she really just got a deep, deep dive into like an integrated system. And she was looking at that, this bits and pieces of ground truth that people have put together or have generated over the years, and you merged them together. And I'm not exactly sure if I had a question or where I was going with that. So I'm going to stop.
I have a question, coming off of that. That's a really interesting point where, Alex, you said that studying Mark's model about, the dynamic nature of the interactions of a cell taught this student about cell biology, but from a very enlightened perspective. And I guess, you know, is that the future of learning? Is, you know, should we be learning based on these interdisciplinary models instead of from a textbook? You know, it's funny you said, you talked about, you know, a snapshot, right? I mean, I just remember, you know, reading the book Cell, which is like, you know, this this thick, you know, when I was
in Molecular Biology of the Cell.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the one I read to start to learn by. I read that like all 1,000-something pages of it on my train rides in between Philly and Newark, Delaware, when I was trying to learn it.
And it was awesome. Just huge, you know, like cross sections of static cells. You know, there was nothing dynamic about it at all. And so, you know, is this the way? And I think, you know, this is a little bit of a selfish question because it brings into relief the importance of biohackathons and experiential learning and doing bio, you know, doing research computationally and otherwise. But, you know, this student, was she better off coming at cell biology and learning cell biology through your model than learning it through a textbook?
Are you asking Alex or me?
But mostly Mark.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, that is a completely unexpected use of the type of models that we build. I mean, I'm very flattered and excited because I never considered that. But in retrospect, I am excited by the fact that this model could be used to try to teach students about cell signaling and like, how does a cell interpret a signal? And then how is that information converted into different currencies within the cell to make it decide to enter the cell cycle or make it decide to die? I think for a certain class of students, it could really help them to learn those concepts much better than just looking at pictures of static pathways in a textbook, mm-hmm. which is the way it's, I guess, taught currently.
Exactly.
I think it's really cool.
Is it a disservice? I mean, to have, you know, cartoons of pathways. Because I mean, like, you have, it's almost like you have to keep going for years and years and years to start to understand how to make that cartoon come to life, right? When you're learning it, especially like you're in high school or something, you don't have a lot of, you know, you don't know how things work a lot of times. You start to perceive it as a static, you know, very simplified, as oversimplified model.
It's oversimplified. Yep.
So you can't see it. It's like, you know, show me, you know, pictures of, you know, different parts of a car and then showing me a car driving with the engine moving. Like, you know, if I've never seen a car before, I'm not sure if I even understand what it is, even if I pass the test, because I can learn what I'm supposed to know for connections and stuff like that. But I just wonder if you started, you know, could you teach a lot of cell biology to anybody with your model? If you had good visualization of the, you know, the information flow through it, that people could see like the process that this is like an engine. And then, you know, you get two, people can understand like make two cells or no cells, right? Like birth or death kind of thing. So I think they could understand conceptually. And then you see all the circuitry in between, like they might, the differential equations will freak people out, right? Especially a lot of biologists.
They don't need to see the equations to, that could be buried and it would be totally okay, I think.
Well, because the way I explain
differential equations to non-math people is, so what Alex is referring to is that the mathematical formalism we use a lot to model cells is based on differential equations, both deterministic and stochastic. But fine. The way I explain it to a lot of people is like, hey, do you have a bank account? Like, yeah, I have a bank account.
I hope so. Sure.
Okay. The amount of money you have in that bank account is kind of important to you, right? Yeah, it's pretty important to me. Like, how do you know how much money is in that bank account? Well, I track what goes in and I track what goes out. Like, yeah, and that gives you your current balance, right? Yeah. Well, that's all I'm doing, but I'm doing with molecules. And that's how I know how many molecules of a certain type I have at any given moment in time in the cell. And that's all the math does. It's doing keeping track of your molecular currencies in a sense. So that's the way I explain it to people. And then they don't need to know that it's a differential equation and how do we solve it and all that stuff, which would overwhelm most people.
Yeah, but that's so interesting because when I took all this math right for years and years. I mean, I always think like I'm in like a 15th grade. Right. Like in college. Right. And I finally,
I don't know what grade I'm in anymore.
Yeah, I know. Right. It's like insane. But I got over the whole, like, I had a really bad, almost like failed out of math and failed out of my major biochemistry. Cause I just wasn't trained properly you know, early, and I finally got a really good teacher, and I learned my math. So I learned my calculus, and I took all this stuff in the month period, and I finally got to differential equations. This is the pinnacle of my math career. And I remember that I finally understood the utility of math after all that training when we talked about compound interest. Right. I remember following like two pages. I could never do it now. It's been so long, but two pages of, you know, of solving these equations and seeing like a big number, you know, based upon, you know, interest rates and stuff like that. And it was that's really interesting that you use that in that as a example of that, because it's so really powerful stuff. And that's right. You know, I think that, like, you know, putting this stuff into more like practical terms like that, like, it just goes so much further and getting people excited about, you know, science, and, you know, maybe remove some of these fears they have about it.
I try to simplify things to their, like, as simple as they can make them, so people learn the concept. And because I've been so interdisciplinary throughout my career, I got pretty good at saying the same thing in different ways to different people,
good,
depending on what I know their background is. So, but I mean, coming back to this idea of using these types of models as teaching tools, I think that's a great idea. I think it would be pretty easy to make a web-based application that would visualize the model and make some sort of interface where somebody could interact through a web page to change things in the model and see what happened.
Yeah. Bingo. Experimentation.
I think some competent biohackers would be able to do that pretty quickly, I think.
Yes. And so if you're out there, please email us at Praxis AI, and we'd love for you to work on that model. So it's, you know, it's interesting because, Alex, you mentioned high school. I mean, I think, I think in order to unlearn some of the static, you know, training that most of us get in biology, especially cell biology early on, is you need this first. You need this at the beginning. And I kind of, you know, going back to the car analogy, you know, the high school students or even earlier, they learn what a car is from Grand Theft Auto, right? And, you know, the video game. And so, you know, from that perspective, they're not reading about cars or pieces or parts. And guess what? They don't learn how to drive a car, you know, from a manual. They don't go through the tutorials. Nobody reads the manual anymore. They just turn on the Xbox and they go. And they learn along the way, and they experiment, and they crash, and they, you know, but it's so natural. And I feel like, you know, with this model you just described, Mark, that would be, wouldn't it be exciting to learn how a cell works from the
beginning? By
breaking it? by, you know, turn it into a game, make it interactive, you know, whatever it is, but live inside that cell and make mistakes, watch it die or blow up or whatever. Because I think trial and error and experience and interactivity, gaming, if at all possible, these are ways that, you know, people will learn, and then they'll keep that knowledge forever. I mean, it's kinesthetic learning, right? So, I mean, that, I don't know. It just occurred to me, we're off down a rabbit hole, but I love it. It's exciting. This is why we do these podcasts. So to bring it back full circle, so you have your model, and you're doing all this cool research, and you're interdisciplinary, and you're kind of representing things. Now we have a new model, which we're going to rush off and create this training tool. But tell me how that leads to blotting innovations.
Oh, okay.
Tell us that story, that meandering story.
Yeah, so that's a company that started about a year ago. And as part of my research, I realized I really... like the inner engineer in me always wants to just tinker and focus on technology for technology's sake.
Yep.
And so I've always had that flavor of research going on in my lab. And I think Alex was mentioning this too. So many assay techniques or ways to measure things in biology are static or they're hard to make dynamic. And the other thing about it is that a lot of times it's really hard to get what's called multiplexing. Like if you want to measure, say you have a sample and you want to measure more than like one or two things in that sample, that can be hard depending on how you want to do it, especially if you're interested in it over time. And so we're as a lab, like the ability to do more of that experimentally will really help our ability to build better models of what's actually going on in a cell. So we're kind of in that space. And so what one of those things is, a technique that's been used for, I think, even before I was born, is called Western blotting, a way to look at proteins.
Yep.
And different modifications of proteins that can be important to the cell. But it's notoriously low throughput. Like you can only do like 10-ish samples at a time, and it's slow. And there was this technique that came out, I want to say like 10 years ago or so, called the micro-Western. Mm. And what that did, it kind of miniaturized the Western and made it to where you could do like hundreds of samples at a time, but using about the same footprint. The thing with the micro-Western is that it needed this really expensive piece of equipment called a piezoelectric pipetting instrument, called the nanoplotter. We had one of those at Mount Sinai, and we got the micro-Western technique working. But when I decided to move my lab to Clemson, there was no nanoplotter. And I'm like, I still want to measure things from way more samples. So I wanted that high throughput ability, but I'm like, how am I going to do that without this critical piece of equipment? And those things cost a couple $100,000. I'm like, okay, I don't really, it's not that important to me.
Yeah.
So I started a project when I got to Clemson. I was like, okay, let's see if we can do a high throughput Western blot, but without that nanoplotter that was essential to what it was doing was putting all the samples in very defined patterns on the gel, very small amounts of those samples, like hundreds of them. Okay. So we had this idea then that we could 3D print this cast. Okay. So one part of Western blotting is you have this gel, okay, really thin gel, and that gel, the proteins go into, and you can separate those proteins by their size.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you need a gel to do Western blotting. And normally the wells are all at the top. So what we built, essentially, with some undergraduate students that joined this creative inquiry project at Clemson, was a 3D printed mold that, instead of having just a couple of wells at the top, had like hundreds of little tiny wells all throughout it. So we were able to build that using the additive manufacturing core that's at Clemson. We had lots of design iterations. Here's an idea. We printed it. Oh, it works. No. There was like a lot of trial and error. But we got that going. So we have a preprint now that's, it's almost peer reviewed published. Our first paper, we call it the Meso Western. The Meso Western. And so that is the technology that allows us to do Western blotting instead of 10 samples at a time, hundreds of samples at a time, but essentially the same technique that everybody already knows how to do and about at the same price point. Ooh. So it just makes it way more efficient for about the same cost overall, which makes the per sample cost way less.
Yes.
So that's what the company is based on, that technology.
That is cool.
And yeah, and so my two co-founders are two of the students who worked with me and got their degrees from Clemson that worked on that technology. We said, okay, like, we think this is valuable. Let's try to make this happen. We founded the company, myself, Jonah Huggins, who is joining the BDSI program in the fall.
Oh, good.
And I think he takes part in some of your biohacker stuff, doesn't he, Alex? Jonah?
He's been in there. Yeah, he hasn't deep dove yet, but he's been there.
Shout out to Jonah the biohacker. Awesome.
Yeah. And Arode Zadeh, actually. So we started this company. And we're like, okay, well, what we need money, because like, what are we going to do without money? Like, each of us has our full-time jobs, and like, we're doing what we can on the side, but like, we need money to buy supplies and buy equipment and like, hire somebody maybe even. Yeah. So what did we do? Like, we went through this boot camp that got us ready to submit a grant application to NIH, National Institutes for Health. Them and multiple federal agencies have what's called SBIR or STTR grants, which are grants that support small business.
Great.
And so, okay, let's try to apply for one of these grants and see if we can get it. And so we applied back in January, and we just got word that it's being recommended for funding.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations.
So any day now, thank you. Yeah. So any day now, we should have some money to see if we can put these ideas into action and actually turn the technology into a set of products that people will actually buy.
Yeah. And it will help improve the efficiency of research. I mean, it has a very good feel-good component, obviously. And what a cool example of find a need and fill a need. I mean, that's kind of how how everything works. I mean, you know, you had the $1,000 machine, but you know, now you don't, but I want the same benefit.
Yeah.
So let's find a 3D printer and we wish you all the best of luck. So everybody look out for blotting innovations. That's fantastic. So as we start to wrap up, the one of the questions we like to ask always at the end is, you know, we've got a whole community of biohackers out there listening. You know, what is a biohacker to you, Mark?
A biohacker is, to me, would be somebody that, number one, they're asking a good question. Or they're trying to solve a hard problem that hasn't been solvable before. And they are doing it by trying to leverage data that's already out there, or sometimes some problem specific data, but trying to use modern computing and mathematics and statistics to get an answer to that question or problem, leveraging the totality of data they can get their hands on that are relevant to that problem. And it, like, and then I guess the approaches are whatever they decide might be useful, but that's how I view it.
That's great.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, one of the things we're trying to do with that is exactly what you said, but be a guide. We're trying to be, you know, have, there's a spirit guide that's involved with directing people to the data. Especially, you know, young people don't know where these data sets are, you know, if they haven't discovered yet. And then like, and how you use the software and the computing to be able to answer questions. But it is, I love that answer. I mean, it's very question based and very science based, right? And it's, learning how to think that way and then having the ability to, you know, validate your thoughts and your theories are just, it's incredible.
And from a bioscience perspective, I think, you know, these biohackathons really bring kind of three different components to bear. One is the question. So that, you know, it always starts with a couple hypotheses or, you know, a question. In the Bill Passman's case, it is, you know, what's the connection, if any, between his rare kidney cancer and his brain tumor, for example. The next is the collaboration that occurs. You know, we break up into teams. Each team has a particular hypothesis or an approach. It can be anything. It doesn't, you know, it's not pre-prescribed. And then the third and most important one is they're collaborating, is access to the skills and resources that they need in order to try and answer that question. You know, whether it's high-level computing, lots of data, excuse me, for storage, whether it's, you know, the we give them access to these cancer transcriptomics journeys and the Praxis, you know, learning platform so they can get spun up, you know, pre-hack digital badges, that kind of thing. So great answer. And you know, a plug for the biohackathons as far as how, you know, that gets implemented.
Yeah, I think those are really great ways for people to get practical skills and learning. How do you actually use that data? How do you access it, and then how, like, what are some ways that you need to clean it up and use it? And it's hard to learn that stuff if you don't have this sort of system or somebody showing you along the way. So
yeah, it doesn't work. You can't make a textbook of it. You can't have a static textbook because it changes minute by minute sometimes with some of these databases. And so it's not the way we did in the past. The cell biology book, which I read, that one, loved it, learned so much from it, right? But then there's just this so, you know, theoretical or just not living. It's not, you could blow that open with models and access to databases and really just see the way it works, right? Based upon current knowledge. So,
and then there's that contribution element as well. I mean, you know, at the end of the biohackathon, you're writing papers, you're submitting code to GitHub, you know, you're sharing, you know, like you're sharing your models, for example, and some of your discoveries, Mark, you know, through the peer-reviewed papers. I know Alex is, you know, very prolific contributor, you know, to the scientific community. So, you know, it's never too early. High school students should be writing papers and submitting to GitHub so that they can start to share in an open.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've had high school volunteers in my lab in the past, and they've ended up on some of our best papers as co-authors.
Yeah. What an exciting, you know, and invigorating experience, you know, reward for that. So, well, thank you so much. Any last final words from either of you?
I'll talk for another hour, so I'm going to shut up.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. We really, really appreciate you joining the show. That was fascinating. Love it. And look forward to seeing that cool web app for teaching cell biology through your dynamic model.
I think that would be really cool.
That's our next project. And then we'll follow up with another podcast episode about it. So,
all right.
Thanks everybody out there for joining us. Cue the closing theme.